All right. So open up to Deuteronomy 6. That's the first place we're gonna eventually land here after I kind of try and reintroduce us to where we are in the storyline. All right, first, in case you don't know it, this is a poem you need to memorize. So it's four lines. It's very simple. I want you to repeat each line after me, okay? So I'm going to say the line, and then I want you guys to actually repeat the line, okay? Run, run, the law commands. But gives us neither feet nor hands. Far better news the gospel brings. It bids us fly and gives us wings. Okay, this is the story of Deuteronomy. All the promises, blessings that God's people could have ever had, and yet not the circumcised heart that could carry it out. Here we are on this side of the cross with the actual blessings, the gifts to actually carry this out. Let me know, Trevor, if I need to scoot back or something. All right. So Deuteronomy is one of the biggest transitions in the Bible. And in fact, you could pretty well argue it's the centerpiece of the Old Testament. Okay, people would call it, obviously you have the end of Moses' life and the people then moving into the land. This is going to be where they are for the rest of the Old Testament until exile. And we don't have a lot. They actually come back from exile. You want me to keep going? I can yell if you prefer. So they're transitioning into the land, but Deuteronomy could literally be the centerpiece of everything because the chapters in Deuteronomy are going to be what spell out everything else that's going to come. So, for instance, Deuteronomy 12 is all about where are we going to put our worship center. Where is it going to be? Where's the mobile place of where we're going to set up this tent? It's kind of a more permanent place, and God has all these instructions and restrictions on where this worship center should be. Well, once you start moving over into the rest of the books, the history books, the constant refrain is, you know, what's wrong with what Jeroboam did? He set up high places. You know, what's constantly wrong with even Josiah and Hezekiah is what it'll say they're the greatest king Israel's ever had, but they didn't tear down the high places. Right? The issue is there's these other competing centers of worship. And chapter 12 had set out there's only going to be one. It'll be established, it'll be the place. And so it's Deuteronomy is this constant ringing thing as the rest of the writers are kind of explaining biblical history. Or you get to Deuteronomy 17, which explains how the king is going to function in Israel. So this is long before there's ever actually a king, and Moses is spelling out what it's looked like. And the king is supposed to be a not kind of person on this side and a yes kind of person on this side. To the no, he's not to build up some sort of storehouse of gold. He's not to get horses and all sorts of other resources from Egypt.
You can put this in your pocket.
Sorry. He takes care of me.
There you go. Right. Stick that one in your back pocket.
All right. Thanks, guys. Sorry to be such a hassle. So no horses from Egypt, lest the people get caught up, no gold, but then no wives, right? It explicitly says in Deuteronomy 17, don't take for yourself bunches of wives. So that comment that you read in the book of Kings about Solomon and his many wives leading him astray, the person who's writing it is not just making an observation. He's read Deuteronomy, and then he said, Solomon broke Deuteronomy. So you've got that. But on the positive side, the king is supposed to be this Torah-centered man who's just Psalm 1 meditating on it day and night. right? Just think what the history of Israel would look like if the king had obeyed Deuteronomy 17, and every time a new king is inaugurated, they sit down, they write out their own handwritten personal copy of the Torah, read for their own reading copy day in and day out. I mean, the rest of the history of the kings would have looked so different, as opposed to everyone's surprised and has no idea where there's even a Bible in the land until Josiah discovers one under some rubble in the temple. So you've got that as kind of this constant refrain, especially in the Psalms and others, like everyone's supposed to be meditating on the law of the Lord. Everyone's supposed to be paying attention to the instructions God has given us, and yet there's no sign of it. And then Deuteronomy 18, right, the prophets, so Deuteronomy 18 has instructions about how the prophets should be, how you tell a false prophet from a right prophet. But what do you have in the rest of the storyline as the historical books come out? You have the king standing and a false prophet over here and a true prophet over here, and the kings of Israel are kind of debating, like, oh, he's got good advice. I like what he's saying because it itches my ears. But he's over here. Jeremiah is the pain in the side of the king for just constantly just saying, this is what the Lord says. This is what the Lord says. But they're making those evaluations because Deuteronomy 18 has spelled that out. And so you can see how even just those three chapters alone have cast a kind of shadow over the whole rest of the Old Testament. So that's just why the book is central. Now, let's talk about the context of it. So at the end of Numbers, Israel is in the plains of Moab, and that's where this picks up. The first generation has come out of Egypt. They're all passed away. The entire first generation besides Joshua and Caleb are gone. By the end of this book, finally, Moses will be, he'll die up on the ridge on Mount Ebal overlooking the promised land. So there's no one left. So this Deuteronomy then puts us in place for, you have the title, The Covenant Renewed. It's some people will also call it almost like the covenant at Sinai, the Mosaic covenant kind of finished. Almost like, so Moses comes down in Exodus, right? He breaks the covenants, but then he has to go back up to get the written copies again. So he comes down and those are put in the ark. And so there's somewhat of a finished covenant there with the ceremony that happens. Blood is sprinkled on the altar. Blood is sprinkled on the people. It's happened, and yet here they are needing it repeated, yes, because they're a new generation, but also because, I mean, the mediation that happened there, this is kind of a finalizing in some ways. It's that covenant, almost like, Deuteronomy is almost like an appendice that's put on as to bring this whole thing to a conclusion so that we have the law. We have more, when Jesus is in the New Testament talking about, you can see me in the law, the writings, and the prophets. Law becomes kind of a term, a description for all of what's written by Moses. Kind of one encapsulated group of books, but one set of instruction. So what Deuteronomy does then, it's structured by basically just three sermons. It's three sermons by Moses. The first one, in the first few chapters, is just historical kind of recounting. This is where we were, and this is how we got to where we are today. And then the second one is where he starts to fill in what's going to be at the heart of what it means to be God's people. And then the third speech, in covenant language, is these kinds of stipulations that each person puts on each other. So Deuteronomy is formed a lot like a normal covenant treaty. So a covenant, pretty simple definition just from, is a binding agreement between two people who already know each other that brings, it makes it more solemn. It makes it more sober-minded. So in a marriage, you're taking two people and then they're devoting themselves to a whole bunch of responsibilities to each other. Right, and so this You know, this covenant is doing the similar things. It lays out who are the two parties, of course, in this case, God and Israel. But Moses then starts spelling out, okay, here are our obligations to one another, and here are the blessings and curses in how we live out that covenant life together. If you live with me in our covenant agreement, and you do it by, you know, the things I've laid out, then there are blessings and blessings and blessings. And of course, especially Deuteronomy spells out the material blessings, especially that they get by being with God. It just flows out into all of life. But then there's a long, long list of curses. And so the people are going to repeat these at the end of the book. So those are the three sermons that kind of shape most of the book of Deuteronomy. So with that said, let me just give you a little bit on this prologue. Actually, but I guess before we look at Deuteronomy 6, flip back just a chapter to Deuteronomy 4, or two chapters if your Bible's got five extending really long. Look at verse 35 is where I want to pick it up. So he spelled out how they've gotten to this place, and then in Deuteronomy 4, this is how he sums up their travels to this point. To you it was shown that you might know that Yahweh is God and there is no other besides him. Okay, so that no other besides him is what is going to then be picked up in chapter 6 here in a second. But it's clear, right? You shall have no other gods before the Lord your God. So verse 36, out of heaven he let you hear his voice that he might discipline you. And on earth he let you see his great fire. You heard his words out of the midst of the fire. And because he loved your fathers and chose their offspring after them and brought you out of Egypt with his own presence by his great power, driving out nations greater and mightier than you to bring in to give you their land for an inheritance as it is this day. Know therefore today and lay it to your heart, Yahweh is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. There's no other. Therefore, you shall keep his statutes and commands, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land Yahweh your Lord is giving you for all time. So there's the summary of their travels. It was so that they could actually know the Lord, right? And we said a couple weeks ago, what was happening with Numbers is it's one thing to bring the people out of Egypt. It's another thing to get the Egypt out of the people. And so that's what's been happening through all of these things. And Moses is summing that up. So that's the history. God's been gracious. And that's the charge. Follow God alone. So once they're in the land, because now the issue is, how are you going to act once you're in the land? Deuteronomy is setting them up so they can go into the land. So speech number two, it's broken into two parts there. The first part, love and faithfulness, and then the second part, the justice and holiness. So turn to Deuteronomy 6, turn back over, and let's look at this together. So if you don't know, Hear, O Israel, the first few lines of verse 4, is the Hebrew word Shema, which is why this is recited over and over and over again in Jewish circles, regardless of how orthodox or faithful the Jew is to anything in Judaism. They still know the Shema. This is always memorized. And it comes from those first couple words. So verse 4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. These words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. Bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and your gates. All right, so just let's look there at what the Lord is actually saying. So if Deuteronomy is kind of the centerpiece of the Old Testament, this becomes kind of the centerpiece of what the faith of Israel is supposed to look like. All right, so Lord our God, the Lord is one. Yahweh is one. It's at minimum saying that there's only one God. that all the other, but more than that, as we read kind of there in Deuteronomy 4, the issue for these people is that they don't understand the uniqueness of God and put that into practice. So they are they're a hedge your bet kind of people. So they are always Yahweh worshipers throughout the whole Old Testament. The issue is that I'm going to go worship Yahweh and do what I need to there, but I'm going to hedge my bet by sending this offering to Baal, or I'm going to hedge my bet by making sure this is also in place. Or if there's something else I can do to make sure I get God's blessing, great, I'll do that too. So this, at the beginning of Deuteronomy, is helping eliminate that whole sense of things. There's one God, but you treat him as the unique God. Everything else in comparison is pointless. All the other gods, as we read in Deuteronomy 32, are actually, what stand behind them are demons. So it's a call to see God not just as the one God, but to see him as the unique God. This is what Yahweh is. And then the command, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Okay, and we know, because we sit at the feet of Jesus and his disciples, we know that Jesus has placed this as the greatest commandment. When he's asked in Matthew 22, Luke 10, he immediately says, this is the first and greatest commandment. Love the Lord God with all your heart, soul, here and strength. So I think we've said before, I think it's come up in sermons lots of times, the heart is kind of the center of everything for a person. In Hebrew thought, it becomes kind of this controlling emotions, reasoning, thinking. It covers all of those areas. So it's not by any means a call to emotional love of God. It's a call to everything we are. And then soul. I'm not sure how much these overlap, but the idea of at least the Hebrew word for soul there is tied up in other places with desires and longing. So you have kind of who you are in your heart, your reasoning, thinking, those kinds of things, and then along with it in your soul, you have passions, desires, longings. I mean, it's just right. You know, it's getting a picture. But I think what then adding might does to it is essentially says the with might is the with all you are being tagged on at the end. So love God with heart and soul, just putting the pieces together, and then might just emphasizes that's all of you. So all of you goes into this. So I mean, you get that picture regardless of how you read it, but Moses is not allowing pieces of the Israelites to just drift into whatever they want. Right, and of course then, that has to flow out in obedience. And the first place here is that this is communicated to every single generation. Every generation who then hears about these things is supposed to come to know the Lord. And it says there at the end of Deuteronomy 6, eventually one of your sons, one of your kids is going to come to you and ask, why has the Lord given us these commands and statutes and laws? Do you know how to reply? Do you know how to express what the Lord has done? So Moses is putting in their mouth the beginning place. Well, the Lord did this for us. The Lord gave us these things. And so within an Israelite structure, this is how communication flows. And the psalmist picks this up too. Psalm 72 starts talking about this is how one generation commends it to another, and then he starts spelling out Israel's history. This is how God brought the king. This is how God did this. And so it's one generation commending what the Lord has done to the next generation. This is right at the heart of Israelite religion. All right. So there's love the Lord your God. But Deuteronomy 7 brings this great kind of emphasis in verses 7 and 8. Because in case you might think the cart would get before the horse and these people would just have to pony up love for God, God tells them where their love comes from. So Deuteronomy 7, 7 and 8 just say, it was not because you were more in number than any other people that Yahweh set his love and chose you, for you were the fewest of all peoples, but it's because Yahweh loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers, that Yahweh has brought you up with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. All right, so, I mean, when our New Testament doctrine of election is explained, it relies heavily on this as well. God's pattern in electing for himself and choosing for himself a people is to look at people who are not worthy of being chosen, who don't have intrinsic value for what he's actually looking for. People have intrinsic value by being made in the image of God, but when it talks about him looking at them and saying, okay, what kind of nation should I choose? How do I want my people who represent me to talk about the history of Israel? Do I want them to talk about how they were the greatest nation of the earth and I came and dropped a few extra blessings on them? Moses explicitly cuts the knees out from underneath that in saying, you weren't mighty. So he cuts out military power. You know, you weren't numerous. So he cuts out just sheer, you know, expanse. They don't have a land. They don't have a place to even call their own. When he went and got them out of Egypt, they were under somebody else's thumb. And yet, because he loved them and set his affection on them, they are now in this position. So Moses explicitly cutting out the knees from some sort of we're worthy, and instead helping the Israelites see this is what stands behind them as a special people. All right. As we turn to the chapters here of justice and holiness, let's at least think for a second of if our story, if the Christian story is very similar in the same kind of way that we have come to actually know the Lord, then at least the parallels as far as us not allowing other idols to compete becomes something that we all then handle as well. So, right, we don't, America doesn't have a lot of shops where we have little statues to bow down, but if you take a second and say, okay, where are our ziggurats? Where is the money most clearly demonstrated and going to? Right, and once you drive by Kansas City, you see giant skyscrapers. It gives us a little pretty good hint that's the gist of where our temples of worship are. We build them to get as high as they possibly can. They stand out, right? In an easy heartbeat, our hearts are drawn towards those kinds of possessions, and God is displaced. So, just a reminder, because Jesus has said the same thing to us. Love him, heart, soul, mind, and strength. All right. Now, as we go through these laws, I just want to give you a brief overview for a second. Typically, the laws get broken up into categories. The traditional way you're going to read in most books is they're going to get broken up into moral rules, ceremonial rules, civil rules. I would say, and Tony and Jeremy, this is something we all happen to agree on how this works out, but the Bible itself never actually describes the rules and the laws getting broken up that way. It comes to Israel as a one package. Now, it's completely fair to just say some of the rules go straight to what do we do with sacrifices in the temple. Some of them are like the Sabbath and others are about keeping certain days and times, festivals and those things. They go with what goes with living among a theocracy where God is king. And some of them are just moral rules. Now, when we come over into the New Testament, we don't simply go back. Everyone knows this by default. No one goes back to all the rules and tries to just bring them over. Now, we know when we read the Gospels that some of them are completely like food laws. Jesus explicitly says in Mark 7, this abrogated food laws. They're done. No more. And then you see in Acts 10 with Peter and Cornelius, he's not worried at all about going and being with Gentiles. He's got kind of a hesitation about it at first because he's rooted in this, but then he knows that that's real. But when we go back, we are looking for we're looking for principles, and we're looking for the character of God and how that comes over. So if you would read through from all the rules and stipulations about the temple to prophets to kings, there is much described about the righteous God and the character of God that runs through the entire stream of the Old Testament. Those things constantly inform us. So there's one thing you can look for. As you read the Old Testament, you're looking for how does this describe the character of God? And often the biblical writers are so good about showing how these laws actually do show something about the character of God, how he's righteous, holy, devoted. Now, the most important rule for when you do that is you sit and you learn from the feet of Jesus and from the apostles of how do they look at Old Testament rules. So many of the same kinds of Ten Commandments, the things that are brought up in Deuteronomy 5, are brought out by all of the commandments. You look at Ephesians 6, and it says, children, obey your parents, for this is right. That goes regardless of what covenant you're under. That goes all the way through. So now as people who are under a different covenant altogether, we don't go back and try to ever find righteousness or put ourselves under that covenant. We instead live gladly in a different covenant with different rules, with a different set of stipulations. And so just a reminder, our division between those is clear. So I read Deuteronomy 32 first because I wanted to make sure that I got a part of it out. But the third thing that comes across when we talk about the law is, and Jeremy has been bringing this out in Galatians especially, is we rejoice. Because just like the Israelites, we weren't keeping any of that law. Jesus has upheld it all. And there you see it under number 3. So finally, this covenant renewal. Turn to Deuteronomy 27, or 28, sorry. So we'll just close on this. Moses he's giving commands for a future date for how they're going to kind of do this covenant renewal ceremony. So they're supposed to have a party at some point at which they come back and say, this is our God, this is how things work. So he sets up this mountainside, two mountainsides that are kind of with a valley in between where there's a city. And on one side, 6 of the tribes are supposed to gather up and they're supposed to repeat the blessings in Deuteronomy 28. On the other mountainside, the other 6 tribes are supposed to come over here, and they're supposed to repeat the cursings. Now, this actually happens in Joshua 8. So you can go there and read how this is all set up. And so almost another picture of the two walls of water happening and Israel passing between. Here we are in like a covenant ceremony. Or, you know, another picture is Genesis 15, where the animals are split and God passes through the middle. The people are split, separated, and they're reciting to one another the blessings and curses. So starting in verse 10 there, you can see, all the people on the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. Lord will make you abound in prosperity, fruit of your womb, fruit of your livestock, fruit of your ground, and within the land the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. Abraham's promises being fulfilled right in their midst, that he was going to give them a land and all the blessings that come with it. And now, the big chunk of the chapter, as you can see there, all the way from 20, I think they start in verse 20, or verse 15. If you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God or be careful to do all his commandments and statutes that I command you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. And listed within that is the exile, kicking out of the land that was promised to happen and that eventually happens first to the northern kingdom and then to the southern kingdom. And it's like a second Eden. These people are going into a land full of milk and honey. It's pictured as another kind of Eden. And they're being brought back into, being placed into. But without the love, without the relationship to God, they eventually, just like in Eden, are booted out and kicked out and sent away. So you have another like picture of what's happening within Genesis 1, 2, and 3 happening again in Israel's history. So it makes us especially thankful that our home in righteousness, our Eden, is guaranteed by another, a more faithful covenant member who actually keeps all the promises, who actually then takes all the curses so that we don't have to, right? And those are the themes and the words that then begin to give us categories to describe what Jesus is doing. He's mediating. He's accepting curses. Galatians 3, 4, that he's and when Tony was finishing up and going through Hebrews, you know, a different law being brought to us now, a different priesthood and now I'm drawing blank of all the lists of the new things that we have because those things were fulfilled and we can have this new covenant with different regulations, different relationship, different joys for us, including the gift of the Spirit. So. All right, let's stop there and prepare to sing and get our voices ready.